started this new series called Breaking the Cycle. And the idea of, for a lot of us, we are stuck in these mindsets or attitudes or behaviors that are, like, we can't seem to break out of. Maybe it's a bad habit that we've had for a long time. Maybe it's the way we treat our family or our friends. Maybe it's the way we look at other races or other people. And there are mindsets or attitudes or things that sometimes cause us to be in this spiral. And what we're saying over this next 5 weeks now is actually, God, if you are almighty, if you are the one who created us, can you break us out of this cycle? But actually, if we're saying, can you break us out of the cycle, that's actually not what we want to be asked. What we want to ask is actually, God, will you break us out of this cycle? And it's one of those things where you are stuck in a cycle and you can't get out of it. You need some sort of external force or someone else to come and try to break that routine that you're in. That's why for alcoholics, they have an intervention or something. Well, they'll come and sit down and say, look, you've got to break out of this cycle, and you've really got to sit down, and we're throwing all your drugs in the trash and stuff like that. But that would be drug addicts, not alcoholics. Right. What I want to talk about today in terms of breaking the cycle is being anxious or being worried. And what I'm calling is be still my anxious heart. But I don't mean by be still my anxious heart is you get so worried that your heart stops beating and you die. But rather, actually in this modern day and age, we get so caught up with worries and with fears and anxiety and stress. And it becomes so normal to our life that sometimes if there are no problems going on, we will make some problems because it's almost in the anxiety and that stress that you feel something is happening. Now, for a lot of us, actually, just in our workplaces, in our work situations, it's just really stressful. Job security is something a lot of us think about. Whether or not we'll have enough money to keep the trust or the business running. Whether we have enough customers coming in to keep things going. There's always this kind of fear, like maybe we're not doing enough, maybe we're not keeping up. For students, there's always the anxiety of exams, the worry that somehow you haven't revised enough. Usually the case is you haven't. And there's always that sense of panic, like, oh no, I've got to hurry up. What will I ever do? I remember the anxiety, I don't remember, but I remember a lot of teens telling me the anxiety of the day you get your A-level results. Which I always think is very funny because it's actually too late to change that result. Why worry, right? Whatever is in that paper, that's what's going to happen. There's no reason to be anxious before it happens. And that's this quote from Winston Churchill kind of, I think, gets us started thinking about being anxious. Winston Churchill says, when I look back on all these worries that he has, I remember the story of the old man who said on his deathbed that he had had a lot of trouble in his life, most of which had never happened. And I think that's the big thing about worry. A lot of times worry is just in our minds or the potential of what could happen, of potentially how bad things could be. And on one hand, we imagine those scenarios so that we might be prepared for when that trouble does strike. But on the other hand, sometimes we let those worries become so amplified and so magnified that we struggle to function. We struggle to deal with it. This next quote comes from this book, Having a Merry Heart in a Martha World by Joanna Weaver. And she says, I come from a long line of Swedish warriors. I don't speak Swedish, so I will pass on that. My grandma Anna used to say over and over, dear me, too high, too fast, too much, too little. With all the potential danger in the world, there seemed to be only one response, worry. I remember lying in bed at night going over my list of fears. Somehow as a young teenager, I determined that the secret for avoiding trouble was to worry about it. In fact, I worried if I forgot to worry about something. Now, I think that probably describes some of us in this congregation, where we feel like, yes, that whole sense of worrying, that maybe I'm not worrying about something, but I should be. This idea of actually nowadays in this world, it's becoming more unstable. I think obviously most of us weren't alive during World War II or during major wars. And at that time, there was the threat of actual bombings happening, and you would hear air raid sirens and things going on like that. And when you would hear that, then your worry would take the next level, and then you would act on it. But in our modern life, there are no air raid sirens anymore, are there? It's just something bad could happen at any time, in any place, in any circumstance, in any way you can imagine, or even worse, in the ways you can't imagine. And that's why we're finding more and more people being really stressed about trying to figure out how to live in this world. Now, the question is, how do we deal with this anxiety, and how do we deal with this worry, and how do we deal with this stress? For a lot of us, what we do is we try to plan it or map it out and say, okay, well, these are what's going to happen. Then you try to run some statistics, say the chances of this are happening. But even 1% chance means it's dangerous. So about 10 years ago, I had 15 years ago, I had laser eye surgery. It doesn't mean I became Cyclops and I could shoot lasers from my eye, but rather I had LASIK, which means they shot lasers into my eye to burn down parts of it so that I could see perfectly now with 20/20 vision. Clearly, the iPhone has changed that. And so my mom said, you should go have LASIK because you don't take care of your eyes and you should really, you're going to be in England. I'll pay for your LASIK surgery. And I'm like, okay, whatever, mom, if you say so. So she sent me to go in, have a consultation. The doctor looks at me and said, oh, yes, yes, you're old enough. Your eyes should not be deteriorating more. I think it's fine. Let's go ahead and do it. Are you okay to do both eyes at the same time? I'm like, I don't know. I guess so. I was like a younger teenager, did not really read through the terms and conditions. I said, okay, my mom said do it, so I'll go ahead and sign this off. And by young, I was like 21 or 22, should be an adult. Anyways, so I signed it off and went back home, and then my appointment was made. And I come in on the day of the surgery, and I'm in the waiting room, and they're showing this video of LASIK surgery. And they're like, and it's like, oh, they stick this thing on your eye, and then this blade, this automated thing cuts off like the tip of your, I'm like, oh my goodness. And I'm having both eyes done. They said, yeah, normally you just get one just in case something goes wrong. You won't be blind in both eyes. And I was like, clearly I should be more worried about what should be happening, but I was not paying attention. And at that point, my anxiety level just shot through the roof, and I'm like, oh my goodness, what happens if I go totally blind? And then I got so nervous that I'm like, I think I have to back out. But by then I had signed the forms. They're like, nope, sorry, you were already going to take your money, so you might as well. And of course, I had my eye surgery. It was fine. I'm okay. And then Apple developed the iPhone, and I spent so much time looking at it, my eyes are bad again. But what I was kind of saying is, when you don't know something, you worry. But then sometimes when you know about it, you can worry more. It seems like every parameter we look at, there's no end to the worry or the stress that we might feel. Worry can turn into fear, we can turn into anxiety, which can turn into stress. And when you are not in control of a situation, it can increase that kind of thing. And a lot of times, if you're not in control and the anxiety and the worry heart, then it kicks into depression. You fall into this thing. And we know this is the case because nowadays, people are trying more and more to figure out ways to deal with this. Maybe distraction, playing games or playing on your iPhone or your PS4 distracts you from the real world. That's why my brother-in-law who works for a startup is really high on VR technology. I know you. And I'm like, whoa, but that's also very dangerous because it's such a way to escape the stresses of reality. Is that a healthy way to actually deal with stress or anxiety? The other thing that happens nowadays is you have stress or anxiety and your GPs only have 10 minutes to talk to you, so they say, fine, we'll just prescribe you something, and that will help ease some of those fears or those worries. They started medicating kids younger and younger just because it makes it easier for the parent and for the child to deal with stress and the worry and anxiety. It's why people turn to drugs or to alcohol. My friend who was smoking, when I asked, why do you smoke? He said, well, actually, because nicotine really helps me de-stress. He knows it's bad for him, but it's the stress levels. All of us try to come up with different ways to deal with stress and anxiety, don't we? Comfort eating, comfort sleeping, comfort not thinking, comfort anything is our way of dealing with these things. But is that the best way forward? Is it the right way? Some of these are not bad. Going to see your GP can be really helpful sometimes. Sometimes you're dealing with stuff so much that actually having something to biologically help you get through that is important. But a lot of times, those only deal with some of the symptoms. But what we're really asking is, God, can you break through the way we think about this world to really deal with our anxieties and our worries and our stress? If you just start listing the things that you're worried about, your marriage, your friends, your future, how your children are going to turn out, whether you'll have children, whether you'll ever get married, all these things on this list, it's about saying, God, okay, I don't want to get stuck in this cycle where I'm so stressed out that I go see my doctor in 10 years and I have high blood pressure, hypertension, and I'm on the verge of a heart attack because of all these stress and worries in my life. So because of that, I want to look at two characters in the Bible, and I want to focus on two things that the worries are caused by. The first worry that I think a lot of us have are things we're not in control of, a situation that we're not in control of. But either we feel like we're supposed to be in control of or we're responsible for the situation, but we're not. And it seems out of control. And that's very stressful. The second thing I want to talk about today is actually stress of guilt. Now, this is one we don't talk about too much, but actually when you are guilty, when you feel like you've done something wrong, and you know you've done something wrong, that guilt, that is really stressful guilt. It's the kind of guilt in the Bible they say, my bones are withered up and I feel dry because I know I have wronged you. And that's that thing, right? That guilt is like when you've done something bad and you've got to tell your parents, but you don't want to tell them because you're like, oh my gosh, that is really stressful. It's like you know you got bad grades on your test and you have to tell your parents. It's one thing to be worried about how you've done your test. It's another worry to have to tell someone in charge. And guilt, actually, you find out, is one of the greatest things that causes anxiety and worry. One of the reasons some people are so afraid of death is because they say, I don't know what will happen to me when I die. Is there a God? And if there is one, will I be judged? And if I will be judged, will I really be okay? Am I really good enough to be in front of a God? They're the kind of questions that start making you think, well, let's just not think about this and let's just do something else. Okay, let's start up the PS4. I'm going to Netflix and chill tonight because I do not want to deal. Give me a glass of wine and that's how I'm going to cope. But it never really solves the problem, does it? So I look at two characters in the Bible. One is King Saul and the other one is David. King David, actually, but before he becomes king. And King Saul was the first king of Israel. And he came about because at the time, the Israelites were saying they were kind of ruled by committee. And they said, no, we want a king. All the other countries are having kings. Can we get a king too? And God says, I don't even want a king. King's going to tax you. He's going to make you join the military. And they're like, no, we want a king because I think that that's easier for us to look to someone and follow them and trust their leadership. And God says, I'm your king. And God said, and they're like, well, we can't see you and we have to go through the prophets. Can you just give us a king? So God says, fine, we'll give you a king. And so the prophet at the time, Samuel, he goes and God says, okay, this is the king that I've chosen for you, King Saul. And it's really interesting because first he goes to find Saul, the Samuel, before he sees anyone else. And he says, the Lord has anointed you over his inheritance, okay? So he pours oil over his head. And then he says, okay, now Saul, God is with you. God's power is with you. I want you to go back to the city. They're looking for you. They're going to see what's happening. You're going to tell them what happened. He goes back. And they start asking him, oh, what happened? And he says, yeah, I'm glad you found the sheep, and that's all. He doesn't say that he was anointed, and he said he saw the prophet Samuel, but didn't say anything. And you get this feeling already that this guy is already stressed out about the fact that he's going to be the very first king of Israel over nation. And it's not something he was trained up for, and you can tell he's kind of feeling a little bit overwhelmed. So then this passage goes on in 1 Samuel chapter 10. Then this is the part where they're kind of have like a coronation, where they're going to say like, okay, God's now going to choose the king from all the people. So Samuel gathers all the tribes together and says, okay, now what we're going to do is we're going to cast lots because at this time this is the way they did it. And eventually the lot is going to fall on. God's going to make it work. So the lot that falls on, that will be the person. And so they go through the tribes first, and they say, okay, now it's going to come to the tribe of Benjamin. And now the tribe of Benjamin, they say, okay, it's going to be this person, and then this family. And from that family, they say, okay, well, it's apparently going to be Saul. Saul, you are the great winner of today's bingo. You are going to be king. And they say, Saul, where is he? Where is he? And they're looking for Saul, and they're like, has he not turned up yet? Where is he? And then God says, he's hiding behind those bags and those pots over there. And so they go over there, and here's this guy who's hiding behind stuff because he's like, I don't think I can really be king. I'm so worried about things already. I'm just going to hide here. And then Samuel goes over and says, brings him up, and he stands up. And he's actually taller than most people, and he's handsome, and he looks like a king. And he's, you would think, oh man, if I look like that, I would be really confident, bordering on arrogant. But here's this guy, and he's timid, and he's afraid, and he's worried, and he's anxious. He's starting to get stressed, and you'll see later in his life, he ends up being really depressed. Here he gets, and he said, this is your king, look at him. There is no one greater. The power of God is with him. He is already worried and anxious about things that are out of his control. Like, he doesn't think he can be a king. Now, before all this happens, you know when Samuel anoints him, he actually says, God is going to be with you. You don't have to be afraid. You just have to believe that God is with you. And he will help you and teach you and show you how to be a king. But from Saul's perspective, he doesn't see or understand that. He's like, okay, this is my burden, my responsibility. What am I going to do? And when we start seeing in his life more and more, he just keeps trying to take control of the situation, and he keeps making a mess of it. Because actually what God is saying, learn to obey me, learn to trust me. And then you won't be so worried and so stressed about things. So here's the scenario. So God's told him to go and fight the Philistines. So he gathers about 3,000 of his own people, and his son has another 2,000. So in total, he got 5,000 people ready to go into battle. And so his son goes out, and the war has been declared already. So this battle's about to start. And then the Philistines show up, and they have a few people. So they show up with muster to fight with Israel, and they bring 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. So let's think about this. So you're king. You get some troops together to go and fight. You've got 3,000, another 2,000, you've got 5,000 people, and then you look out to see your enemy, and they have 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen. And troops as far as the eye can see, basically. And of course, he starts to panic. Because number one, he's supposed to get ready for this battle. Number two, Samuel said, okay, don't do anything. Wait for 7 days and I'll come back and then the God will tell you what to do. So he's got to wait. So if you know, if you're ever in a position of stress and then someone tells you to wait, every day gets more stressful, right? So he's got to wait for a whole week before he does anything. And he's looking, and meanwhile, all the people start panicking. So we'll read on. They came up and encamped in Michmash. Now, that's a great name for a place. To the east of Bethaven, when the men of Israel saw that they were in trouble, for the people were hard-pressed. The people hid themselves in caves and in holes and in rocks and in tombs and in cisterns, and some Hebrews crossed the fords of the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul was still at Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. So essentially, all the people look at this, all the soldiers are like, oh, I'm going to just go to the bathroom for a bit, and maybe I'll see you later. So they're hiding in caves, in tombs. Some of them are fleeing across the river. You'll find out later that they only end up with like 500 men to fight this battle. Like, it's way overnumbered. So this is what happens. So Saul is really panicking. He's trembling. He's really worried. He's filled with pressure. The expectation of both his kingship, his responsibility. He's also filled with fear, which then, of course, leads to panic. Right, and we understand this. If you have an anxiety attack, a really bad anxiety, it's a panic attack, right? Where you suddenly, you don't know what to do. You're like hyperventilating, and you get the sense that actually Saul is in this very same place. He is so overwhelmed by this stress, and he's got to wait 7 days. So he's worried and anxious, and then what does he do? So actually what he does is then he waits for 7 days, and Samuel hasn't showed up yet. So he says, okay, I can't wait any longer. I got to do something. I don't know if God's going to show up. I don't know if what's going to happen. We're way overnumbered. I'm going to get a bull. I'm going to sacrifice it myself. I'm going to take an offering. I'm going to cry out to God, and God's going to answer me because, you know, hey, I'm king. Just give me a call, see what's up. So he does that. And then as soon as he does that, Samuel shows up and said, what are you doing? He said, I made an offering because you weren't here yet. And like, there's like a ton of people. We're going to die. And Samuel says, "That's you don't get it, do you? You're stressed out and you're worried, but actually all you need to do is obey God. You got to obey him. You got to trust him. Well, why? Why would you trust God? If you understand that God is bigger or sovereign over everything, if you understand that the scope of time and humanity and history is all understood by God, you begin to realize, oh, actually, I am not as important or as powerful or as big as I think I am. And maybe the more I trust in God, the less I have to be stressed about things. The only thing I have to be worried about is actually, am I patient enough to listen for God? I think that's one of our biggest struggles, right? Actually waiting to hear from him. And I know what it's like, because sometimes you're praying and you're asking God for an answer, and then nothing happens for like a day, and you're like, I don't think I can hear from God. I don't think I'm that kind of Christian. Oh, I don't think I have that power. How do you hear from God? And so we're like scrambling around, trying to ask people for tips and clues. Can you give me a hint? I want to click on the hint icon, and can it illuminate a section? And like people are like, well, you just pray, read the Bible. Say, I don't like those answers. I want something like I can do to make it happen now because I'm getting anxious. But what we see is actually sometimes it's just patience. When you begin to understand that God is the God above time, 7 days for us when you're stressed is really painful. But in the scope of God, he's like, well, I know how long your life is going to be. 7 days actually is not going to kill you. It's just a week. Maybe it's a year. But still, the year between 41 and 42 is not that big of a difference. The older you get, the faster you count the years go by. It's a matter of just saying, okay, God, I'll trust you. But that's not what Saul did. Saul did this, and then eventually he panicked. He panicked and just rushed into something, only for Samuel to say, that's not the right way to go. The second thing that we see about King Saul is that he is worried and anxious about things he's done wrong. Real guilt. And this is the other part I want us to think about. Like, actually, there are things that we might be guilty for. Things that we regret. Things that we know hurt people. What are we doing? There's the guilt that we do actively, and then there's also the guilt that we kind of do on the side. Like, oh, I heard about all those children in Syria and all those refugees, and, you know, we're taking a collection for them, but I bought some trainers instead. But I don't want to feel guilty about that. It's my money. I can do what I want, right? That's okay. I'm okay. That's okay. It's not a big deal. You know, it's okay. And it's hard, right? Because we never want to think about that, because even though we're in the West, we're pretty much the 1% of the world in terms of finances. No one likes that feeling of, don't make me feel bad, Bert, okay? It's not, I live in the West. It's not, and there's no excuses, right? We have no place to go down that line. All we just want to do is, can we just move on? I just want to deal with that kind of guilt. Because that guilt makes us anxious, makes us stressed out, makes us, I can't fix the world's problem. I don't know what to do. So I buy trainers because at least that helps me get through my day, okay? Is that what you want me to say? I don't know. We're going to see here, actually, throughout all of history, people have been trying to figure out ways to deal with guilt. You see in Shakespeare, Macbeth, out damn spot, how do you deal with this guilt that I've done? You have Edgar Allan Poe's Telltale Heart, where he hears it beating because he's done this crime and he regrets it. Before then, you had all these ritualistic sacrifices to try to take away the guilt that people have. And we have figured out ways to make ourselves not feel guilty for things. Like, everyone else is doing it, it's okay. Let's just say that it's okay. Let's accept it. That makes it right, right? If everyone accepts it, it must be okay. If everyone votes Donald Trump in, it must be okay, right? People seem to know what they're doing. And that's the problem with when we just say, guilt's not my responsibility. I can blame someone else. And that's what drives me crazy about the U.S. election. They're all blaming Donald Trump. The Republicans want to blame Hillary Clinton. But really, the Republicans' best candidate is Donald Trump. Who's responsible for that? But actually, it's not really, is it? It's a society that loves entertainment. Where did that come from? Oh, it comes from a love of selfishness. Doesn't it boil down to that kind of selfish? You just want things that entertain you. But where does that come from? Well, we just want a distraction from things. In other words, the further back you push, the more you realize we do not have very many answers for the problems of this world because they seem to stem from something much deeper inside our hearts. So if we're Christians, we're saying, okay, God, can you break that cycle here with us? I would love to save the world, but let's start here with me. Like, you know, I don't want this guilt to force me into bad decisions and bad actions anymore. So let's see what happens with King Saul. So he's been actually asked in 1 Samuel 15, he's been asked to go and wipe out the Amalekites, okay? And so these people, when we hear about God saying wipe out these Amalekites, we think, how could he ask to do that? The best way I can say is, actually, God knows the hearts of all these people. He knows whether or not they would repent or turn back. We see in other times where God says, go and tell these people they're really evil, but I know if you tell them, they'll turn back to me. These Amalekites, you know, we're talking child sacrifice was the norm. We're talking about, you know, killing, sexual abuse. This is normal in their mindset. And it's gotten to the whole point where the whole society is like that, and God says, look, you've got to bring judgment around that. Otherwise, they're going to keep coming and attacking you. This is what you've got to do. And you can't take any spoils from this. Don't take any of their cattle or their oxen, okay? Leave that all behind because you want to cut the bad parts off. Don't bring it with you. Now, of course, King Saul goes there, and what's he do? Oh, I say, okay, well, you know what? I'll take that, the king. I'll take Agag guy. His name is Agag. I'll take him prisoner. Kind of, you know, show off to other people. Look, I've conquered these people. Look who I have. That's what they would do. And then he's like, oh, look, they have so much good sheep and oxen. Let's just take some. We'll just take the good ones for offering to God. So that's what he did. So he took it. And then Samuel shows up. Samuel says, "What are you doing here? I thought we were... God clearly said, don't take anything. Leave it. Kill it. You don't want that stuff." And he's like, well, and so we'll have a look at this. Saul said, well, they have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spare the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have devoted to destruction. Then Samuel said, stop, I will tell you what the Lord said to me this night. And he said to him, speak. So the first time Samuel asks, what is all this going on? And what does Saul say? Oh, it's the people. All the people. By the way, you are king. You know what you say goes. The people just decide, and you're like, okay, it's a democracy. Let's take a vote. Who wants to keep the sheep? Okay, great. I don't think that's how it worked back then. But he doesn't take responsibility, does he? He just shifts the blame to the people. And he tries to cover it by saying, oh, but it's for the offering of the Lord. That's the first time. Actually, Samuel says to him, this is what the Lord says, speak. It says, Samuel says, though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go and devote destruction to the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you pounce on the spoil and do what was evil in the sight of the Lord? There's two amazing things that happen there. One is, he says to King Saul, you know you feel really small, insignificant. You know you're little in your own eyes. But you're king. Do you understand who God has made you to be? Don't you trust God, what he's done? He's chosen you. He believes in you to lead because God is with you. But he doesn't. And then he asks him, right? So he says, why did you do this? And Saul says a second time, so I have verse 17. Verse 21, Saul says, but the people took of the spoil sheep and oxen, the best of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. In other words, hey man, I'm sticking with what we decided in before we got arrested. We're going to stick by this thing. It was the people. The people decided it. We're going to stick to that. That's my excuse. It's not my fault. It's not my responsibility. And again, it's one of those things where maybe the stress of the situation, the stress of being a king, he doesn't want to bear that burden, so he just tries to offshift it. And we've seen this happen a lot, haven't we? Especially with financial crisis, where all the blame just keeps shifted further and further to someone else until only one person eventually gets prosecuted. even though the blame falls so many other places. This is the second time. And actually, after that, Samuel says, "Has the Lord as great a delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen to the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king." The third time, this is Saul's response. And he said, "I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now, therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord." In other words, even at the very end when he says, "Fine, I was wrong. This is my excuse. It's because I was afraid of the people." In other words, come on, just own it. Just say, "You know what? You're right, God. I was made king. It's on me. I'm sorry." And that's sometimes the hardest thing for us to do. If you ever had to apologize to someone, don't you always want to say, "I'm apologizing, but I want you just to hear my side of the story. Okay, I'm saying sorry to you, but I only did that." If you are saying sorry and the next word that comes after your word sorry is "but," not a good sign. Okay, "I'm sorry, but," unless your name is "but." Or the person you're apologizing to, their name is "but." In other words, we have this thing where actually there's a denial, there's excuses, and there's a "not my fault." That's how a lot of us actually deal with guilt and with sin. We deny the fact that it's real. We deny that that's something wrong. We make excuses, and then we say it's not my fault. One of the strongest places you see that is in relationships, actually is the worst. Your marriage, your family, your parents, where you're always like, "If they would change, that would make it better, but they can't, so it's not my fault that this marriage is falling apart. It's not my fault that my parents and I don't get along." At some point, someone is going to have to own up to the responsibility and say, "I can't change how they feel, but I can change how I act and how I live." It's where at this point I want to look at the contrast, King David. And this will hopefully help us figure out how does he deal with things that are out of his control. And I want to show you that actually he's in still bad situations, okay? So he's out of control in this situation. So actually, he was actually next anointed to be king because God said, "Look, you can't be king anymore, Saul, so the next king's going to be David." But David is not going to overthrow. He's not going to do Game of Thrones on King Saul. So he's patiently waiting. He serves him. He works in the... And then eventually King Saul's like, "I hate this guy." Every day he probably looks at David, he's getting more and more angry, and he tries to kill him. Then David and King Saul's son, Jonathan, they're friends. They find out, actually, yeah, King Saul is just trying to kill David. So David runs. He goes and flees. And he's hiding in caves now. No place to live, all right? And then King Saul shows up. He gets word on the street. If you read 1 Samuel, it is seriously straight out of, like, a Netflix show, because it's like, they go in, and he just kills everyone there. They go into a priest, says, "Why'd you give him bread?" And he slaughters everyone, and then they go off and fight. So he takes 3,000 men, he's hanging out in these caves, because like, he knows David's there. Now, when we read in 1 Samuel, read the story, it's like, oh, and David's so courageous, and he's so loving, so forgiving, right? So what happens is, all the men are hiding there, King Saul's outside, then King Saul needs to take a dump, he needs to do a poo. So he goes up to the caves, and he sits down to do a poo. Well, squats to do a poo, because they're Chinese. No, they squat to do a poo. And King David and all his men are like, "Oh, this is your chance. God has delivered him into your hands. You go and kill him." And David says, "No, I can't kill the king. That's not right." So he goes up and cuts off a piece of his robe, King Saul's robe, and he takes it. And then King Saul finishes up, does his thing, goes back down, and then David comes out and says, "Hey, I could have killed you. Look, here's proof. I cut off your robe." And King Saul's like, "Oh, I see. You are a greater, more merciful son. I won't bother you anymore." And so we read that, and we think, oh, man, David's just amazing, right? He has so much peace, so loving. This is how he deals with stressful situations. Until you read the Psalms. And during the time King David was hiding in these caves, he also wrote two Psalms, Psalm 142 and Psalm 57. And in the Psalms, you actually hear his anguish and his stress and his fear coming out. And you realize, oh, actually, King David had emotions too. He was anxious. He did not know what to do. He's hiding in the cave, remember? And you realize, well, how does he deal with this? We're going to look at part of Psalm 142. And this is where the real meat of how you deal with worry and anxiousness comes across, okay? So in Psalm 142, it actually starts out, "With my voice I cry out to the Lord. With my voice I plead for mercy to the Lord. I pour out my complaint before him. I tell my trouble before him. When my spirit faints within me, you know my way. In the path where I will walk, they have hidden a trap for me. Look to the right and see, there is none who takes notice of me. No refuge remains to me. No one cares for my soul." "I cry to you, O Lord. I say, you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Attend to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors. They are too strong for me. Bring me out of prison, that I may give thanks to your name. The righteous will surround me, for you will deal bountifully with me." Looking at that, you begin to see actually the first thing that he does is he cries out to a greater power, to God. Because he knows he is not in control of the situation. He has responsibility, but he sees for himself, actually, the one who is in real control is God, and I don't know what to do, and I'm going to cry out to him. That's some of the hardest lessons for us to learn, actually, to say, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm going to start out by asking God, can you help me? And in his prayer, you can see, like, I'm pouring out my complaint to you. It's not just my complaint, my hurt in my heart out to you. And he's saying, when my spirit faints within me, you know my way. That sense of exhaustion, that sense of burnout or fear that's so overcoming, I just want to give up. I can't do this anymore. He doesn't just pump himself up and do a Hulk Hogan and hit his face. I'm like, yeah, yeah. He says, God, you. And he starts doing this thing, which is very interesting, but very important for us to see. He starts declaring who God is. In this part, he says, you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Attend to my cry. Like, he gets it. Look, he can't solve this for myself. So I say, God, you're greater. You're awesome. You're powerful. Help me. Actually, attend is even stronger than help me. He says, attend to me. Come near to me. Be with me here. I know you are. And you start realizing the biggest way he deals with worry is in his crying out to God, he says who God is. He declares who God is. And that is basically worshiping, saying, God, this is who you are. And as you begin to say who God is, you start realizing, oh, actually, I'm like a blip in the wind. I'm like nothing. I don't have to be stressed about this. I don't have to be worried. I don't have to be anxious. God has much bigger plans for the whole world than what I'm going through right now. And I can actually just start trusting you for the strength to study harder or the strength to deal with the coworkers that are driving me crazy, the strength to just get through the next hour. I can look to you because you are God. You are true. You are real. He says, bring me out of prison that I may give thanks to your name. And he says, you know what? Actually, God, do this. Because actually, if you help me through this, I can just praise you more. Because you are victorious. You're awesome. We'll look quickly at Psalm 57. Same thing. It says, be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me. For in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge till the storms of destruction pass me by. So in this you start saying, he sees, like, you know, God, actually, be merciful to me. I'm going to rest in you because I know that you are greater and bigger and better. When you begin to understand this, you're not afraid of anything. You're not afraid of even dying. Because you're like, actually, God is in charge. I'm not afraid. I'm saved by him. My life is in him. Even if I give up my life and I die, or someone in their horribleness kills me, God, you are my savior. In this day and age where it's becoming more troublesome, more fearful, and people are looking for more ways to run, what I'm trying to learn is, God, actually, what does it mean to really give my life to you? If people are in need, if a bomb goes off, do I run from the trouble, or do I do my best to go to those who are in need? If God is really calling us to be his people, it means you don't just run from when everyone else is suffering, but you run to those who need help. Now that's a tough challenge, right? Because it's like, no, that means you're going towards the danger as opposed to away from it. What if there's another bomb? What if there's like, I don't know, but what it means to follow God means, God, I trust you with my life. I'm not going to be stupid, but I will give it to bless other people. This world needs more of God's courage, more of his trust, more of his faithfulness. This Psalm 57, in the second part of it, actually has this part where it says, it's very interesting, so I did English literature, but if you notice, my heart is steadfast, O God, and then he repeats it, my heart is steadfast. And then he has this thing, I will sing and make melody. So there's two things. He repeats things. Now, repetition is really important because if you repeat it, it actually helps to make it more real for you. It helps to remind you of it. And actually for us, if you are going through something stressful, declare something about God. Say, God, I know that you are great. Just repeat it. God, I know that you are great. And this is what David's doing in his psalm. He's repeating these things because it's helping to remind him, my heart is steadfast, O God. His heart is probably not that steadfast, but he says again, my heart is steadfast in you, and I will sing and make melody. Then he says, awake my glory, awake, O harp and lyre. I will awake the dawn. Awake, awake, awake. In other words, wake me up from the way I'm looking at the world to see actually just who you are and worship you. Then it says, I will give thanks to you, Lord. I will sing praises, for your steadfast love is great to the heavens, your faithfulness to the clouds. In other words, for us, the best way to deal with sometimes anxiety is pray, declare, remind yourself of what's true, and worship. And just spend time in those things. It doesn't take a lot of time, actually. I know a lot of you people who work. What do you do if you're really tired at work? If you're really, really tired and you're starting to fall asleep, you go to the bathroom, don't you? You go to the bathroom and hide for a little bit, a few minutes, and then you come back out. Yeah, I feel a little bit better, and you hope no one knows that you're gone for, oh my gosh, it's been an hour. You come back, you sit back at your desk, you're like, okay, I feel a little bit better. Actually, I feel worse because I took that nap, but at least I can go on. If you're getting really stressed out, you take some time out and just say, actually, God, let me focus again. Recently, Apple added this function to their Apple Watch called Breathe, okay? Because Tim Cook is, more yoga-ish. But basically, the science behind it, if people stop and take a moment of their day to breathe, it makes them better. Now, breathing is fine because everyone, we should all do breathing. Okay? All of us should breathe, otherwise you would die. But breathing to yourself or breathing to no one is just breathing. But if you take that moment each day to breathe to God, to reflect on him, it's not just breathing, it's prayer. It's not just prayer, it's God, you are. It's really refocusing, recentering yourself on someone who is true and where your life really is. You take a minute to do that every day, just before lunch, just before something, it's like, actually, God. And so what I've been doing is using a memory verse, just taking a memory verse, and that's my memory verse for today. And I'll just reflect on that and say, actually, God, this is really good. Because it helps me remember what life is really about, what's really important. Finally, very quickly, how did King David deal with anxiousness from his own guilt and sin? So actually, King David did a really bad thing. He was up on his roof, he's looking out, I don't know what he's doing there. Saw this girl taking a bath on her roof. Oh, really pretty. So he said, hey, guards, go get me that girl. Because I guess he's the king, he could do that. Girl comes over. Anyway, so she gets pregnant. Oh, I don't know what happened there. Well, we kind of do. But anyways, she gets pregnant. King David's like, oh, was not expecting that. Okay, here's the plan. She's married. She's married. Oh, King David's married too, but he's got like, other wives. So he's like, okay, well, what can I do about this? I know, I'll invite her husband, who's a soldier in the army. He'll come back. And when he's back, I'm sure he's going to mess around with his wife because he's been on the front lines for a while. So yeah, that'll be good. And the baby will be theirs. No problem. No DNA testing. It'll be cool. Okay. So he comes back. The guy in the army is such a good guy. He's like, how can I come back and sleep with my wife when all my other soldiers are on the front, are in battle? It would not be right of me. So he doesn't. And King David's like, what is wrong with this guy? So what does King David do? Sends a message to his general. Oh, tomorrow, can you put this guy on the front lines? And then the general's like, but he'll die. Oh, okay, well, that's a side effect. So what does the general do? General puts the guy on the front lines. The guy, Uriah, gets killed. Oh, how tidily this Game of Thrones story has wrapped up. So what happens is King David said, oh, well, okay, Bathsheba, you're my wife now. All cool? Everything's cool, right? Everything's cool. Prophet Nathan shows up. Hey, David, I'll tell you the story about the guy who doesn't have very many sheep, one sheep, and this other guy who has tons of sheep. The guy with tons of sheep goes and kills the guy with one sheep and then takes that sheep. What do you think about that? King David, that's horrible. No one should do that. Who did that? I'm going to go and bust him up. And then Nathan's like, gotcha. And King David's like, now, this is what's interesting. This is how he deals with his guilt and sin. He does not make excuses. He just says, I have sinned against the Lord. He just takes responsibility. It's my fault. I have sinned against God, number one, above all. And the hardest part about confessing or taking responsibility is at that moment, all the guilt and all the blame ends up on you. And that's why we don't want to do it, right? We don't want to take all the blame. We don't want all the guilt. He's like, it's all me. It's my fault. Whatever punishment there is should be on me. I take responsibility. And that's hard to do, isn't it? What happens is actually Nathan says, God has forgiven you. But there's still a punishment. Your son's in Bathsheba. He's going to die. David fasts and prays. Says, God, please, don't, save. Please, please, please. But God's punishment is still there. There's still a cost to be paid. And then it makes us, it's important that we understand there's a cost for things. Nothing is free. There's cost for the choices that we make. But instead of being worried about it, it's where you say, actually, God, and that's why I choose you. Actually, what's important is that I choose to obey you. I choose to follow you. We get a little bit more insight because actually in Psalm 51, this is the psalm that David writes after Nathan talks to him about what he's done wrong. And he says, have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love, according to your abundant mercy. Blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. He just asks God to completely forgive him. Now, this is really important. If we have done something wrong in our life, I know the first thing we're thinking was, maybe I should apologize to the person. Maybe that's the second step. But the first step is you just have to come before God. God, can you forgive me? Can you cleanse me again? Can you forgive me again? I know this is like the 100th time I've prayed this, but can you forgive me again? And this is so important because when you are forgiven, the anxiety and the stress from that goes away. But the fear of not being forgiven, that hangs on you. That drains you. So it's just saying, God, will you forgive me? He goes on, he says, and I won't have it up there, but it says, for I know my transgressions, my sin is ever before me. Against you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. Purge me with hyssop and I shall be clean. Wash me and I shall be whiter than snow. Let me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones you have broken rejoice. He goes straight to God. Actually, I do have it here. When it says here, for I know my transgressions, what this is all about is actually confession, where he's saying, God, this is where I've gone wrong. He says, let me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones that you have broken rejoice. Hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. Cast me not away from your presence and take not your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation and uphold me with a willing spirit. And the next thing is that he actually asks God for restoration. Bring me back into your arms. Bring me back into your family. Then he says, O Lord, open my lips and my mouth will declare your praise, for you will not delight in sacrifice or I would give it. You will not be pleased with the burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. O God, you will not despise. In other words, God will forgive you if you repent. And because of Jesus, we have that life. In other words, there is real freedom when you receive the forgiveness of God. Not just, a placebo effect or some imaginary thing or some make yourself feel better. This is actually God's love flowing through you because he has forgiven you. In Philippians 4, 6 and 7 says, be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving. Let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, should guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. When you are trapped in a cycle of fear and worry and guilt, freedom cannot come from within. It's not just going to come from yourself. Freedom that from that comes from God. As we're going to enter into a second time of worship, we have some people who are trained in just praying for people. They're going to be standing in the back, and they have a little tag, this ministry. If there's something that you're anxious, you're worried about, some fear that's been gripping you recently, and you really want to be set free from that, you can just go to the back and just ask one of those guys back there, can you just pray for me? You can either be as specific as you want, or you don't, but this is really saying, God, actually, I want that freedom. If you have some guilt in you, and you also want to confess that and you want that to be set free, come back and ask one of them to pray for you as well. You don't have to confess your sin to us specifically, but I found that when you do that, the freedom that comes to your community really pours out. But if you struggle with that today, just say, you know, can you just pray for me? I've done some bad things. I do some things I regret. Can I just receive God's forgiveness and freedom again? The power doesn't come from the people praying, but comes from actually the community that we share. The ability to share our struggles with one another and then bring it together in God. That's where the beauty in life is. I'll just close with this one verse. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Matthew chapter 11, verse 28. Shall we pray? God, we thank you that you are the one who forgives. You are the one who knows everything that we have gone through, that we are struggling with, that we are worried and fearful about. And God, I pray right now that you break that curse of fear and of anxiety over us. And instead, you give us your peace as you've promised. Jesus, you said you have come to give life and life to the full. So do not let the thief steal any more of our life away from fear and anxiety and guilt. Let us be filled with your peace and your joy now. Lead us into a time of just worship and of prayer and confession. We thank you in Jesus' name. Should we just come and worship? I just invite you guys to stand up if you want. And if you need to spread out, if you want to have some space, and you know, just go to the sides or kneel, or feel free to do that as well. And again, we're back here just ready to pray for you as well.